We made this.
Hi all, Carl here. Just before we get going today, I wanted to flag up the fact that I've had some trouble with my equipment of late, so you might hear some background noise on my side of this conversation. Hopefully this won't hinder your enjoyment too much, and I've bought some new gear recently, so future episodes should be unaffected. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for another new episode, in which I am delighted and thrilled to be discussing the first ever James Bond adventure, Dr. No, in which 007 goes to Jamaica to investigate a mysterious disappearance. And joining me for this episode is a regular guest on the Movie Palace, my friend, your friend, everybody's friend, Tony Black. Hi, Tony.
It's Black. Tony Black.
Thought we might get a bit. Yeah. Well, no, I thought we might get some calypso singing from you.
Maybe I'll save that till the end. Yeah, I do love that. Jamaica. Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah. No, it's a pleasure to be back on. I think it was about a year ago, roughly, we were doing Some Like It Hot around this point in the summer. So it's nice to come back and do another quite different, but a nice summer movie.
Yeah, that was when we were coming back to kind of try and cheer people up through the pandemic. So,
and obviously we did.
Yeah. You know,
it worked. Look how happy everyone's been over the past year.
Actually, that brings me to a relevant point, I think. So actually, before I get to that, first of all, what I will say is for James Bond fans who are tuning in for this episode, I can refer people back to an episode that Tony and I did with Movie Palace friend Gabriella Masson a while ago on Goldfinger. That was a while ago now, Tony. I'm going to say 2019. Does that sound
right? Yeah, I think it was, yeah. Yeah.
But in that episode, we talked a lot about the Bond phenomenon in general and our history as fans of James Bond and that kind of thing. So people, if people are interested, I'd definitely say check that out. In terms of the pandemic, so here's the thing. I remember when the pandemic started, and we talked before elsewhere about how No Time to Die was one of the big delays, you know, the big first film delayed and so on. And I was tracking that closely, and I was tracking like the news about when cinemas would reopen and that kind of thing. And then, you know, we've had like, what, 3 national lockdowns in the UK. And yeah. I don't know, after a certain point, I just started to kind of hibernate and just insulate myself from a lot of the sort of day-to-day news. Do you know what I mean? So what have I missed? What's going on with the new James Bond film, No Time to Die? We're still waiting for it, yeah?
We are waiting until, I think we get it on September the 30th, because we always get it slightly before the US and some other territories. I think it's something like September the 30th. And it's been now about two and a half years in a way, technically, because I'm sure it was supposed to originally come out like in the beginning of 2019. Or was it the beginning of 2020? Either way,
Who knows?
it's moved so much. I don't think anyone's got any track of it now. It's now, I think, going to be almost as long, if not longer, than the famous License to Kill GoldenEye gap of 89 to 95, which is insane. Nobody ever thought we'd have another Bond gap like that, and here we are.
We should have had two, I think, in the period since we had Spectre.
Yeah,
you know, we should definitely be having the second one now. It's a shame. Yeah. Are you still hyped up for it? Are you still feeling excited? Because obviously we went through the rigmarole of here's the trailer, here's the poster, here's the song, and then the rug was pulled. Do you think you can still get to the same level of anticipation?
It's Bond. I mean, yeah, always. I get anything Bond, I am excited about. I will wait as long as I need to wait. If anything, I think it's made the anticipation even more sweet, because it's going to be amazing just to be able to go back into a cinema and have Bond be one of the first big... I mean, I suppose there's quite a lot coming in this summer if it all goes to plan. But, you know, you don't get much bigger than Bond. So, no, I'm thrilled. I just really want to know if, and it's appropriate given what we're talking about today, I really want to know if Rami Malek is playing Dr. No. I really want to know this because I really think the clue is in the title, to be honest.
I've heard the rumour. I don't claim any knowledge on that. So,
no.
Yeah, time will
guess.
Tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, with the proviso that, well, we're recording on the 28th of May, just to date the recording, things could change, we could have cinemas closed again, blah, blah, blah. Hopefully not this time, hopefully they're back for good. One of the other things we've had very recently, as well as we record just a few days ago, is the news about Amazon's acquisition of MGM. So what does that mean for James Bond, and not just for the franchise, although that's a big part of it, but potentially like the classic titles as well? Does it mean anything? Do I need to worry?
Well, it depends on your point of view. I think a lot of people are quite worried about these super titanic mergers that are going on. I mean, there was one, I think, about a week ago involving Discovery and another major channel as well that was merging. There was talk for ages that Apple were going to buy MGM and we'd see No Time to Die on Apple TV, and everyone went, well, nobody owns Apple TV. I mean, we've got to buy Apple TV just to watch James Bond, because I don't want to do that. But now it's going to mean almost certainly all the Bond movies on Amazon Prime at some point. No Time to Die popping up on Amazon Prime before anywhere else. And then, in theory, a James Bond extended universe, which I don't mind the prospect of that, because I think Bond's going to need to sort of modernise in that way to survive in the next decade. But apparently Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson have said, "Oi, you might own us, but you don't control us."
So this is the interesting thing, isn't it? They're still at the tiller. So
yeah.
They still have the controlling say. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it's like that they still own 50% or something, and it's under their control. And logically, I think Jeff Bezos and all those guys probably understand that these people have made Bond into what it is, completely, because it's their family, you know. So he'd be stupid to boot them off and get some no-mark in to do it. But at the same time, I think they're going to be under massive pressure now to, you know, churn more out, because let's face it, we've had since 2000 and... Well, in the last 20 years, since 2002, we've had 4 Bond movies. And I mean, that is not cost-effective, really, is it? Much as Skyfall did a billion and change and Spectre did 800 million and whatever, you know, that's chump change for Bezos. He's going to want a lot more than that. And they're going to see a cash cow here, that they can do a Money Penny series, they can do a, you know, the Chronicles of M, Q, a cool cyber series. You know, that's what they're going to be trying to do. So it's going to be an interesting push-pull between, Eon Productions going, hang on, we've got the way we do things, and then Amazon going, yeah, but we kind of own most of this. So I think it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, we'll have a Bill Tanner origin story. Kind of thing.
Just bring back Michael Kitchen. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're gonna do it properly.
It's gonna be interesting, because they do seem, Broccoli and Wilson, wedded to the more traditional way they've always done things, don't they? And part of me likes that, but just wishes they would work faster. You know, like they used to. Like when we were getting into Bond, and we were worshippers at the Church of Brosnan, of course. And you know,
indeed,
that was pretty much every 2 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, for a good while. It was great, the 90s. It was the heyday for that. And then obviously back in the 60s, it was even more, wasn't it? They were knocking them out a year, every year.
Well, I think that brings us on to Dr. No, which is what we're here to talk about. So I was just wondering how your opinion on this one has changed over the years, just in general terms, because we'll come on to talk a bit about the production and then we'll go on to some of the key moments. But I'm sure I remember having a conversation with you. If it wasn't you, or somebody who looked a lot like you, let's put it that way. This is a few years ago now.
Poor
saying,
person.
Yeah. It was somebody, you were saying that you thought the first Bond film that was truly alive was From Russia With Love, I think is what you said. But then I think I've spoken to you about Dr. No more recently, and it sounded like you were much more into it than that. So is this one you've kind of gone back and forth on a bit over the years, or what?
I think I absolutely appreciate it more now. You know, I'm starting to call these things the Star Trek the motion picture effect, because, you know, slower, more meditative. Dr. No isn't meditative, but it's that whole... it is slower for a Bond movie.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have the formula that we... can't quite remember all of the discussion we had for Goldfinger, but we almost would have talked about the Bond formula, you know, really kicking off at that point. And From Russia With Love has a lot of the Hitchcockian kind of stuff in there, you know, North by Northwest and all that kind of thing. But Dr. No is a curious sort of blend of book and movie that was Bond before they understood in a way what Bond was. And I remember as a kid, I just didn't get, I couldn't glom onto that because I, you know, like you say, we grew up with Brosnan and by then it's basically, you know, it's the formula ultra, you know, when you, it's very difficult going into the cinema and watching Tomorrow Never Dies and then coming out when you're 15 years old and watching Dr. No, because it's a very, very different kind of film. As time has gone on, I feel like I can see how well made this film is, how classy, how cool, and how well kind of structured it is, and tense actually. So I am absolutely a convert. It wouldn't be necessarily bothering my top 10 Bonds maybe, but I think it's really good. And I wouldn't have said that even maybe 5 years ago.
I agree with that because I think even in the mid to late 90s, which is when I was seeing a lot of the Bond films for the first time, these films already seemed very old, didn't they?
You know? Yeah.
In a way that I find it hard to believe that the Brosnan films now would seem as ancient to a new viewer as these did to us back then, you know, even though they're now about the same distance away from them. But I really like it too. I think it's not a top tier favourite of mine, but it is. I do like it a lot because I love the simplicity of it, because it's the only Bond film I think that isn't, to one degree or another, kind of in conversation with other Bond films, if you know what I mean. Because it's unique in the sense that it was this low budget film, and I think that's interesting because we can talk about it. But some of the restrictions of the budget, they actually get around in some quite creative ways here. But it means a lot of the elements here seem fresh because they hadn't been reiterated time after time. So it's really fun to see Sean Connery's first take on Bond, I think. And he could have had no awareness at this point of how much he'd come to be identified with the role. And yet I think there are still sort of traces of that sort of callowness in his performance. But when I talk about the simplicity of it, I think for a good chunk of the running time, it's quite a straightforward detective story, isn't it? With these pulpy edges. And I think that's very refreshing when you think about how the later Bond films become quite different, don't they? They become quite inflated. So I think Dr. No in its own way is kind of unique, isn't it, within the sort of the series?
It doesn't really, because it doesn't hold to any kind of formula, because there are no expectations, it can kind of paint Bond as, I mean, fairly relatable in terms of Fleming's creation, really. It's not to say that all of the films subsequently weren't, but, you know, really, when you start getting into Goldfinger and some of those later films, particularly the Roger Moore ones, it's not really necessarily Fleming's character in quite the same way. By then, he's become the movie Bond.
Yeah.
Because there is, and we talked about this before, I think, there is the distinction between the movie Bond and the book Bond. But Ian Fleming only wrote Dr. No. Incidentally, it's Ian Fleming's birthday today, as we record. He would have been 113. So, you know, happy birthday, Ian.
Yep.
But he only wrote this in like 1958. So it was very early. You know, there wasn't much of a distinction between the book and the film in terms of time.
No, it must be one of the closest, mustn't it? If not,
probably. Yeah, because I can't remember I think it might be book number 6 or something like that, Dr. No. It wasn't the first book. It wasn't the first book in the series. Obviously, that's Casino Royale, but it wasn't even the second or third. And it was interesting they chose Dr. No in that sense to make as the first book as well. But first movie from the books. But yeah, I think it does play a little bit more like a detective story, not like a Sherlock Holmesian kind of thing. You know, Bond isn't some sort of deductive genius, but he's a bit more, I think, what does Dr. No call him? Stupid policeman.
Stupid policeman, yeah.
You know, there's a little bit more of that than the guy in Goldfinger is, you know, throwing an electric heater into someone's bathtub. It's slightly different, even though there are still those Bondian cool moments, but it's before they've kind of figured them out in a way, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the elements of the formula are present from the get-go, but we talked a lot with Goldfinger about how that film kind of codifies it and serves it up as a package in a way that this one doesn't. From Russia with Love, I don't think fully does either. And that's what I really like about both of those films, actually. So yeah, like I said, I don't think I could put this one right up there with what I consider the top tier Bond films. So I don't think it has the depth of something like Casino Royale or Skyfall, which I know that is controversial amongst some fans who really don't like the Daniel Craig direction. I know you and I both do. It also doesn't have the polish of something like Goldfinger. I'm not sure it sustains the intrigue quite as well as something like From Russia with Love, but I think it's a very watchable thriller and a compelling Bond film. It's quite a different, like we said, there's not much of a gap there between the book being written and the film series starting. Do you think the context is subtly different? Because, like, when Fleming starts writing the books, so I think Casino Royale is published in 1953, isn't it? At that point, Britain still had, like, rationing. You know, it's still this kind of post-war context. So you get this very appealing thing where, you know, the idea of post-war affluence hadn't really taken off. So you get these books with this very handsome man who's traveling around the world to these glamorous locations and meeting all these women along the way and whatever. And they come at an interesting time, don't they? Because Britain's in kind of a liminal period, because it's between when the empire declines and you're sort of on the cusp of Britain starting to come to terms with its new role on the world stage. So it comes, you know, Fleming starts writing the books a few years before the Suez Crisis in 56 kind of starts to kind of emphasize how our role has changed, and we're kind of on the decline, you know, in terms of influence. So I don't know, by the time he writes Dr. No, we're a bit further into that story, aren't we? And then definitely by the film story, when the film series begins, you know, there are still traces of the original social context, but we're into the 60s, you know. And then, of course, it takes off and Bond becomes this kind of timeless character who's always in the present day. You know, he's kept continually in the modern context. So do you feel like some of that specific post-war context is gone by this point, or what? What do you think?
I definitely think it's gone in the film there. Yeah, in many ways. I think the film much more sort of reflects, in part, the Cold War tensions of the early 1960s than the austerity sort of Britain.
Do you mean with the, because it's about the American missile, that's what his plan's about and all that?
Yeah, and it's only like, it only comes out only like a year before the Cuban Missile Crisis. So you've kind of got, I think, a lot of tension about missiles, about nuclear confrontation, about all these kind of things going on. And I think it's much more that kind of idea of Bond, and they haven't quite figured this out yet, and I think it just sort of happens, and they capitalize it on it. But Bond being part of the countercultural sort of revolutionary kind of image of this, it's always that interesting contradiction, because Fleming wrote him as very much a kind of wish fulfillment avatar of himself. And that, you know, we've since seen lots of dramas, haven't we, about, you know, Fleming's life, and there are books about Fleming's life. You know, he pops up in stuff like the TV show Timeless, where they're going back in time, and it's Ian Fleming being very Bondian. So it's in popular culture now that Ian Fleming was Bond, and he wasn't, but he did work for the OSS and all these kind of things in the war. And he sort of created Bond, taking aspects of his own past and sort of splicing them with this, you know, charming, if quite dry, blunt instrument, you know, which is what we then see him called in things like Casino Royale. But that was far more, that kind of character owed a lot more to the sort of Etonian set, you know, than old Etonian set. You know, he described him as like Hoagy Carmichael. It was that kind of image of, it wasn't Connery. I mean, Fleming didn't even like Connery in the role at first. You know, he thought he was too rough and ready. And he was probably right in a way, but that's because Connery wasn't representing the same thing. And I think Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman saw that, you know, I think they described Connery as walking like a panther, you know, when he came on screen. And it's, I mean, it is obviously iconic, but you do have to, when you watch Connery playing Bond in that first casino scene, you just, when you watch him walk, after I read that, I watched him walk. And it's true. He's like a cat. He prowls, you know, across the carpet. And it's incredible. You know, the magnetism of him, the sexuality of him I think it represents the 60s far more than the 50s. And I think that's a big difference between book and film, for one thing.
I think that's true. And like, I think from what I remember reading Casino Royale, the novel, there's a moment in there where Bond, it's towards the end of the book, I think, but he's reflecting on how, I think it's when he's convalescing, you know, he's sort of saying, today's conservatives don't seem like conservatives anymore. So you get this sense of him being kind of a throwback. And I think in that context, that's about, you know, the fact that when the conservatives came back in after the Attlee government, they didn't roll back the NHS and all that, the welfare state. And I think a lot of that context, obviously, is not relevant here. One thing that is interesting, though, is the setting of Jamaica, isn't it? Because what I didn't realise until I started doing a little bit of research was that... So Jamaica becomes independent, I believe, in August 1962. So the relevance of that is that's before the film is released, because it's released in October 1962, but it's after it had been shot. So, like you say, you kind of have this idea of Bond as a wish-fulfillment figure who... in some ways represents the fact that Britain is still ascendant on the world stage, but in kind of a different way. So like Jamaica still needs us to come and sort things out is the implication, even though we're parting ways. The Americans still need us, even though it doesn't seem that way more broadly, but we have to do it secretly. You know, they need us, but we need to be on the quiet. So we're still leading the way, but from the shadows. So it's quite colonial, isn't it, this film? And you see some of that in an unsavoury way, like the stuff with Quarrel. I think that's one of the worst moments in the film where he's like, fetch my shoes, you know. But do you know what I mean? Like the drinks club and all of that feels very kind of old world in some ways.
I think so. I think the American thing is interesting as well because, you know, obviously Broccoli and Saltzman who buy this, you buy into this, And they buy the rights to this series are Americans. You know, they're the gregarious cigar-smoking American moguls, you know. And Broccoli has a deep love of British culture. And they, you know, he spends most of his career subsequently in England and all this kind of thing. But it is Bond through that sort of American prism as well. So when you're looking at the colonial aspect, it's almost like the film is a bit like British colonialism as seen in a way through an American lens, which I find quite interesting as well. It's like, had this been made by, well, I was going to say Alfred Hitchcock, but because he was in the, not necessarily in the running, but I know that they had an idea that they might like Hitchcock to direct this. And he might have seen some form of a script, I don't know. But he by that point was very American, wasn't he? He was making a lot of the American stuff, so it might not have been quite the same. But I think if you've had a really devoutly British director at that point, it might have ended up quite different in the way that Bond was portrayed. It might have been a little bit more like the Bond from the books. And I think that would have I don't think you would have had the franchise you had, quite honestly. I think this, even though it's not Goldfinger yet, it has a transatlantic appeal that I think it might not have had, you know?
I agree, and I think that in that sense, Dr. No was quite a wise choice for the first adaptation. I can see that having that appeal more than something like Casino Royale or even Moonraker. I think if people have seen the Roger Moore film Moonraker, I think that's the third book. I don't think they realise that a lot of it is kind of just playing cards in the novel. Yeah. It's really good.
It's a good book, but it's so different from that movie. Very different. They keep the villain's name. Yeah. But you find that with so many of them. I mean, and that's part of the thing with Casino Royale. It would have been a really difficult one to do first off. And it's a testament to the Daniel Craig film and just how well that comes off. But they have to do a lot of other stuff in there to make that film work, really. You know, if you'd adapt the book straight off, it would have been difficult. Whereas, like you say, Dr. No, it has in the book that element of Jamaican sort of glamour in a way, if you see what I mean, or that exoticness. And I think that's what you were saying, that exoticism for the average British, particularly more British punter than American, because I think Americans by this point, I mean, this is coming out in the sort of era of Mad Men, if you like, you know, it's that cool sort of American boom era. So I think there was more of an exoticism than you would have had in Britain, where, like you say, the Fleming books are being written in the wake of rationing and things like that. So British people are still wowed by the idea of seeing these beautiful exotic locations and people on screen. So I think that's a big part of the appeal.
Just by the way, I think Harry Saltzman is Canadian. The basic point still remains because it's across the Atlantic, but just in the interest of accuracy.
Good bit of fact check in there. Yeah.
I didn't realise, I think they mention it on the making of on the DVD. And so I watched that the other night. Okay, let's do something we don't normally do on the Movie Palace, because we normally just have a general chat, but let's just bounce off some of these moments in the film. Not necessarily scene by scene in an exhaustive way, but we'll just go through it. So I think the story is that Maurice Binder, who designed the titles, had an idea for the opening. So using this pinhole camera to photograph the inside of a pistol. And of course, it's not Connery here, is it? Because it's Bob Simmons, the stuntman. And it's not followed by a pre-credits action sequence. But it's nice that we get the gun barrel immediately. I think any Bond fan cherishes those, don't we?
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think it's black and white, isn't it? And you've got this weird sound effect.
Well, it's the... thing. And then, it's strange, isn't it? It's not like... But then it kicks in. Then, you have the... And then it's... And it's great. Because what I love the fact that the Monty Norman theme is there right from the... Even though they don't half use it a lot in this film, they really use it all the time. It's good. It's very strange, isn't it? I think it's easy to forget how odd, in a way, that is for sort of that beginning kind of visual. You know, we take it for granted now, and we clamour for it when it's not there, but it is very weird.
Yeah. Of course, with some of the recent films, they like leave it till the end and stuff, and it's just not right. So hopefully No Time to Die, it's right up front. there is tons of the Bond theme in this film. That's striking, isn't it? Because it's not even withheld for like big action moments. It's like Bond's walking across a hotel lobby or something, and it's blaring out.
It's quite incongruous, I think, sometimes. You just think, doesn't really fit in a way. like you say, it's in a really prosaic sort of environment.
Some of the context is that Monty Norman apparently was struggling with what the theme of the film would be. He said that Saltzman suggested that Underneath the Mango Tree could be more of a main theme.
Oh, wow.
And of course, we hear that a few times in the film.
Yeah.
And then Norman remembered music he'd written for a musical called A House for Mr. Biswas. And this was the genesis of the Bond theme. He was kind of reworking that music. And then John Barry was brought in to arrange and conduct it. So that's what's interesting for me about Dr. No, is there are so many of these things which feel kind of preordained, but they kind of emerged almost by accident or by some strange process of happenstance. You know what I mean?
It's not always the way, though.
Yeah.
You know, always the way it happens, isn't it? You know, who could have, in a way, sat down and written the Bond theme with a knowing sense ability? You know what I mean? It's like, it's one of those things that's so... And I think you find that with a lot of these great theme tunes. That you can't almost... There's a magic to it, I think.
So, Peter Hunt, who was the editor on the film, he tries to give it this kinetic style of cutting. So, for instance, at the opening, when the secretary is shot, you get some rapid edits. There's a moment a bit later on where there's a fight between Bond and the driver. And like it seems like Bond's going to punch him with his right hand, and then you cut, and it's actually him hitting him with the left. So you get like, it's a weird mix, isn't it? Where it's like an urgent rhythm with that kind of stuff. And yet also a very kind of languid pacing compared to what a contemporary viewer would expect with walking across the, you know, doing, we follow him all the way across the airport lobby. We follow him across the hotel. He paces his hotel room. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of an interesting mix there for me.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of it's about trying to establish mood as much as anything else. And I think Terence Young directs with a real sense of class and style. I mean, he was extremely, urbane and sophisticated anyway. He was Bondish in some ways himself as a person. You know, he took Connery to like a tailor when Connery turned up in a suit and he went, oh no, this won't do. We're going to Savile Row. he tucked him and he gets him sorted out. And this is because this isn't Bond, this is Connery. And there's a very sophisticated aspect to him as a director. And I think he wants to create a sense of style and mood. And I suppose in a way a film like this hasn't really been made in this way, has it? You know, it's like action films. Bond kind of broke the mold in a way, didn't it? In terms of action movies, you hadn't really had them in this kind of way before. So I suppose Dr. No has a sort of fusion of different stylistics in a way, sort of an older fashioned, steadiness and I hesitate to say staginess, because that's not it, but a steady pace to it. But then also, like you say, these moments of powerful sort of action and cutting and far more of a modern sensibility of that time.
Yeah, they really punctuate it, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, obviously, we get the classic intro with Bond, and I don't know if everybody realizes this. There's a film called Juarez, which Terrence Young had seen. And apparently this intro scene with Bond is kind of a takeoff of that, because in that film, and I haven't seen it, but Paul Muni's character was introduced in this kind of way where you don't see him at first. And here in Dr. No, we see, you know, we get the shots of the hands. We get a shot of Bond from behind, you know, dealing the cards and all of that. And what Terrence Young actually says on the commentary track is that it's kind of an old interview that they've reused for the commentary, but it's how he kind of intended that to be faintly comic, you know, this delayed intro to Bond. I don't think it really plays that way now, because I think, A, probably most people now don't get the reference to the other film, and B, it's kind of assumed the status as like a classic character introduction, hasn't it? So I was kind of surprised to hear him say it was intended as almost as a half joke, you know?
Yeah, it is difficult to sort of get your head around that, really. I don't quite know what he was going for in a way. You know, was he trying to suggest that the character's ironic in some way? I don't know. It definitely doesn't play like that now. I think he's just too cool for that, you know, in this role. And Connery's humour is different, you know, in terms of what he brings to Bond. I don't know. That is strange.
I think it's just kind of the context is lost, and it was kind of an in-joke. Yeah. And unless you come across that fact, you wouldn't know that, I don't think, now.
No.
I think what they nail from the get-go with Connery's Bond is the cinematic Bond. There's that kind of surface-level duality to him, isn't there, where here you have a man who's very refined, but he's also very brutal. And I think you can say that about all the Bond actors on film, can't you? Maybe not David Niven. I didn't see him being that brutal. But you know what I mean, the main ones.
Peter Sellers.
We'll have to do Casino Royale 67.
Yeah. We should, actually. That'd be fun.
But the thing is, with the film Bond, it's very much a surface-level brutality, isn't it? Or a surface-level duality, I should say. There's no real sign in this film that he has any kind of depth to him or inner life. Do you know what I mean? And in the books that is slightly different, isn't it? Because obviously he has these kind of these wounds in a way, you know, Vesper and whatever. You kind of he lingers on at times, not like excessively, but they're kind of mentioned. So that's what's quite different to a lot of contemporary film heroes, isn't it? Like Bond is very surface level, I think, in the old films.
Yeah, I think that's intentional to kind of allow you to like him a bit more in a way. Like I don't know if people would have really liked the Bond from the books if he'd been adapted quite straight up. I mean, he has things like he talks about how he I might mispronounce this, but he suffers from like acidy, which is essentially like a sort of chronic nihilistic boredom, which is what Fleming had. So Fleming puts a lot of his quirks into Bond himself. And there is a real sense of him being just this bored, posh boy, sort of, in the books at least, kind of, you know, colonial, nasty piece of work sometimes. You know, he's not very likable. Whereas I think the charisma of Connery naturally anyway, which he hadn't really had chance to display properly in his previous films before this, but he's there, coupled with, you know, the fact that they wanted to create a sort of cinematic superhero before they knew what that meant in a way and what that actually was, really. And you put that together and you get a very different, you get a more likable, you get a more charming. Is it this film where he when he goes to see Moneypenny, he takes his hat off and he goes, "For my next miracle," and he throws it on, or is that another one?
I think that's another one, isn't it? I think
that might be another one, but I feel like it already has shades of that kind of humour to it as well at points, you know, and that's not quite in the books in the same way, really.
Yeah, I think the repartee between the two of them is much more a film thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think part of the appeal of Bond, the film character, is we're seeing someone who's quite unashamed about who he is? Do you know what I mean? He smokes a lot. He drinks copiously. He'll take a woman to bed whenever the opportunity presents itself. I think, what, 3 women in this film, I believe?
Yeah, I think so.
Now, we can talk a bit about how that sometimes has a troublesome aspect, maybe. And, you know, there's obviously issues of casual racism that manifests and so on and so forth. But I think the idea being that he represents somebody who he responds very directly to his basic level kind of urges and desires. I think that holds a lot of allure, doesn't it? And with these old films, you see that presented in quite an unapologetic way. And that's something that I think is much more of a struggle in the modern day, and they have to reframe it, which we've seen through the Daniel Craig era, haven't we? In fact, I don't think he smokes anymore, does he? I don't think we've seen Daniel Craig smoke as Bond. Is he the first one who hasn't?
I can't recall.
I remember Brosnan smoking a cigar a few times, but not Craig. Yeah. Do you know what I mean, though? That is something that's different at this vantage point, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was, just to mention it again, but that was a pointed thing with Mad Men when that was on. Yeah. In that the characters smoked, they drank. And when you watched it, and I watched it not so long back, you were really struck by how awful the habits were of these people at that time, you know? And you think, wow, how were they not dead? You know, the kind of things. And it was a terrible message to, but that's the whole point of that show. Whereas, when in this kind of era, that's commonplace. And it adds, I think, to that sense of that. I think, you know, the refrain I remember when I was growing up, and maybe I heard this, was the old idea that women wanted Bond and men wanted to be Bond, you know, and that was the idea, certainly at the beginning. And I think it's changed now, and it's why the character is still in this phase of evolution. I think No Time to Die is going to grapple a lot more with Bond's relationship with women in power and, you know, on a level playing field, which is great. And that should happen. Your character should evolve, you know, times should evolve. But equally, I am a firm believer of that. Part of history is accepting things within the context of when they were made. And I think with Dr. No, there are some questionable aspects, but you won't find many films of this time that don't have questionable aspects to them now. But it's appreciating what they were doing and what they were saying at the time. And I think definitely Bond and Connery's portrayal of Bond at this point was designed to captivate, to glamorize, to enthrall, to make, you know, that boyzone sense of adventure, you know, that they wanted, you know, to get the boys in watching it, and they wanted the girls to swoon. And it was as simple as that, I think, you know, at that point.
It makes me wonder when they recast, you know, because we've gone through the Daniel Craig era, which it does hold more of a lens up to it, you know, for better and worse. And obviously we're not here to discuss that right now, but could they go a more escapist way again? And how would they do that? I don't really know. Anyway, like we've said, so aspects of the formula are here from the outset, but not quite. So we get, for instance, M and Moneypenny here, Bernard Lee and Lois Maxwell. But we also get Major Boothroyd, who is not Q, or is he the same guy who later is played by Desmond Llewelyn? It's not quite clear, I don't think. And we also get Sylvia Trench, don't we, who was meant to be a recurring character in the first six films, apparently. Does appear again in From Russia With Love, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And then that's the last we see of her. I don't know. Do you feel like we're missing out not having seen more of Sylvia?
Maybe if Sylvia turned out to be a KGB agent undercover, then yes. But apart from that, Bond having a girlfriend that, you know, he just slaps on the arse every film would have got tiresome, I think, even then, pretty fast. Yeah. So, yeah. Sorry, Sylv.
Yeah. I think that what they said on the DVD is that the intention there was by the sixth film, that's when she gets a big role.
Blimey. That's a long character arc, isn't it?
What's also interesting is if you watch the theatrical trailer for Dr. No, and I don't know if you've seen it. I hadn't seen it, I don't think, before this week. That actress is actually dubbed in the film, Eunice Gayson.
Really?
But in the trailer, you can hear her actual voice, and it's quite different. Like? It's much more high-pitched, I think, and less, I don't know. It seems like the dubbing is going from more of a glamorous kind of feel, it seems like, to me.
Yeah, a bit more sultry, maybe.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. What Lois Maxwell said, who played Moneypenny, is that she, Terence Young and Connery had decided that Bond and Moneypenny had once had a romantic weekend together, but they decided not to pursue it any further. Which, of course, you don't really get that in the films, but maybe that kind of anticipates what they do much later on with Naomi Harris, you know. Well, they get a bit more interaction, don't they? But I never really knew that before she said.
No, it's not really necessarily on the page in a way, is it? It's like, whereas in Skyfall and those films, it's a little bit more of a, well, have they, you know, maybe they have. But I like that. I like the fact that that's nebulous, you know, and that's a nice little, I would never want Bond to lose that in a way. I quite like the idea. They might be some friends with some benefits here and there. It's quite good.
So there are limitations on this film because they had a much lower budget than subsequent Bond films would have. So with M's office, So you see the wood paneling and the leather door and that kind of thing. But it's not real wood paneling and it's not real leather. And it happens all through the film. So one of my favourite moments, I don't know about you, but it's when Dent goes to see Dr. No. And you've got that room where he goes into where it's the single chair, you've got the circular opening in the ceiling. It's very minimalist, and the reason for that is apparently they'd run out of money. So that factored into the way they shot it. But I love that scene. It's where you don't see Dr. No until very late in the day, but you hear him and there's the tarantula in the cage and all that. I just think in general that Ken Adams' production design is very eye-catching, isn't it? Especially given what we know about the limitations.
Yeah, and he, obviously that just grows and grows as time goes on when they get more money, and the things Ken Adam does are amazing. But yeah, I think, you know, that minimalism can work, you know, in many ways. I mean, I definitely think, you know, you describing that reminded me of the scene in Spectre with the asteroid or whatever it was, you know, and you hear Blofeld off screen, you know, in the, it's great. You know, there's a lot of nods and winks to this. I think this, like you say, elements of formula or elements of style are repeated. They're just expanded upon, you know, as time goes on and they get more money. But, you know, those that essence is baked in from Dr. No.
I really like how some of the tension is quite sort of low-tech stuff. Do you know what I mean? So, like, Bond in the bed, the tarantula there.
Yeah, it's really
sweating,
tense.
Sweating as it's crawling up him. Yeah. And you can see I think people will see quite obviously there's a plate glass between Connery and the spider. I mean, you can't begrudge him that, I don't think.
No, fair play. He was hard, but, you know, there's a limit.
And I love that kind of thing in the Bond films, you know, whether it's a tarantula or an alligator or, you know, a shark or something, that kind of menace.
Komodo dragon.
I love all that stuff.
Well, I suppose it's Bond versus nature, isn't it, as well? That's the thing. That's what's quite cool about it, in that, you know, it's that idea that he can survive anything. You know, and it gets sillier as time goes on, doesn't it? Once you get Roger Moore hopping over some crocodiles, it's a bit much. But like this, yeah, it's really, you feel the sweat like he does. It's very good.
Yeah, I think so. It's Bob Simmons is the stuntman who you actually see the tarantula on the guy's arm. That's who that is, I think. What do you think about, we're talking about maybe there's some troublesome aspects from a contemporary standpoint, and the character of Miss Taro, who's invented... I think she's referred to in the book, but doesn't feature like she does here. Does any of that strike you as a bit iffy? Because I suppose he knows he's going to send her off in the car, but he sleeps with her first, doesn't he? Do you think some of that would register differently today?
Probably, yeah. I it's that sort of casual misogyny and, you know, disposal of women. I think you do have to sort of look at these early Bond girls, Honey Rider's hilarious in many ways, you know, as a figure, a very iconic looking figure, but you do have to look at some of them and you know, they are written very much. I mean, although the irony is there was a female screenwriter on this film, you know, and people might well forget there was a, what was her name? Joanna Harwood? I think it was. It was involved in the writing, maybe not the final draft, but she was involved in one of the Johanna Harwood. Yeah, she was involved in the writing of the film, and you know, even then, I still think it's going through a very male prism. You know, in terms of how this is written. You know, it would be done differently these days, or it wouldn't be done at all. Either way.
Well, some of these things did raise objections even at the time, I think it's worth saying. Particularly the moment with Dent, where he comes in, Bond's been sat there playing solitaire waiting for him, you know. Dent shoots the figure in the bed. And you get the thing where Bond shoots him quite mercilessly, you know, you've had your six, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I believe it is a great line. And I think there were some kind of objections to that at the time. Obviously, they were able to override them and include it in the film. But I'm so glad they did, because I think that's a great example of sort of Bond. He's harsh, but he's also sophisticated. And I think you really see the harshness come to the fore with that scene. And I think that's why it's one of the best scenes in the film.
Did that trouble censors then? Like in many
Apparently
ways?
So.
Did that, yeah. Was it? I'm guessing it was just the coldness of it, the mercilessness.
It. Yeah.
Really. Which, I mean, it seems tame these days, but like I suppose, yeah, watching it back in 1962, you'd be like, wow, okay, that's like cold-blooded murder. But like, But that's it. Yeah, you're right. I think that's exactly it. It shows that balance. It's getting the character right, really. You know, and I think that's it. You if you'd sanded all the edges off, I think it would have been more comical. It would have had that, you know, it would have been Austin Powers, you know. It wouldn't have been what it was. I think they made some maybe quite bold and quite brave choices, really. And it is a classic moment. That is definitely one of the best scenes.
And do you think you can sort of trace a line from that moment through to like some of the Roger Moore moments? It's occasional, but you know, is it The Spy Who Loved Me where he like tosses the guy off the building when he pulls his tie away, you know?
Pyramids! Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it is quite integral to the character in some ways, that kind of coldness, you know.
And it's more shocking when it happens almost out of nowhere. It's like with Moore, there was the slap of Andrea in The Man with the Golden Gun, which is horrible, but you just don't expect that. Or the when he kicks the lock off the cliff on For Your Eyes Only, you know, in the car. Really brutal kind of stuff. Some of it not okay, but that kind of just snaps you back into, okay, this guy's a killer, ultimately. He's not a hero, really. And it's easy to forget that, certainly later on in the way he's portrayed. Yeah.
So what's interesting with this film is it's a long time, isn't it, until Honey first appears. I think it's over an hour into the film, 62 minutes it is. Iconic first appearance in a lot of ways, where she emerges from the water in the bikini, which, of course, then is later kind of inverted in Casino Royale when we see Daniel Craig coming out of the sea in his underpants, you know.
And copied by Halle Berry in Die Another
Day,
although...
Yes. Well, that's what I'm talking about. When I said earlier, like, this is the only Bond film that's not in conversation with the others, that's exactly the kind of thing I mean, where they do these callbacks quite frequently, don't they? Yeah.
Mm.
It's an interesting first kind of scene between them. I think it must be the only time Bond sings on screen, wasn't it, underneath the mango tree? I can't think of another immediately.
No, I don't think so. It's a shame we didn't get him busting out some like Beatles or something. There's some 60s hits later on.
He doesn't like the Beatles, does he? In Goldfinger, he says something about listening to the Beatles without earmuffs would be a mistake. I can't remember the exact line.
Wonder what he'd gone for. Was he more of a Stones man?
That's the thing about that film that's aged the most poor. Well, no, it's not actually. No, there are some things in Goldfinger that haven't aged well. But his opinion on the Beatles hasn't aged well either.
He's definitely wrong there. Yeah.
What do you think about Bond and Honey? Like, do you feel any real emotional connection between the two of them? Does it matter? Are they even trying to create that kind of feeling? What do you think?
It's a bit of a weird relationship, isn't it? Because on the one hand, there is obviously sexual attraction. Ursula Andress is very alluring. Connery just looks ridiculous. But she's very childlike. And in the book, it's even more pronounced. You know, she really is very childlike in the book. She's almost written like some sort of mermaid who's emerged from the ocean. Like, it's ridiculous, but she is that it's not quite on a par, you know, in any way. And so it's a bit, it doesn't really resonate in that way. No, she's just there to be rescued in many ways and to be saved. And it doesn't help the fact that she's dubbed as well. Dubbed. She has gone down in history as a very sort of iconic visual image, but as a character, I mean, she's down there at the bottom in terms of Bond girls, I think, really.
She was dubbed by a woman, Monica van der Zyl. It's the same woman who dubbed Sylvia Trench, interestingly. It was to make... And they do that quite a lot in the early Bond films, I think, is take the woman characters and dub them. And I think that tells you something. It tells you that they're not necessarily being hired for their acting capacity, you know, capability.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be perfectly honest. In fact, Honey wasn't cast until 2 weeks before shooting, and they saw a photo of Andress, and she was offered the role without a face-to-face meeting. And yeah, her accent was quite heavy, so they redubbed her to make it milder. So I agree with you. I think there's kind of a disconnect here because of that. I think it reinforces the sense that she's mainly designed as eye candy. I mean, there are fleeting attempts, aren't there, to give her a bit of depth, because she talks about her backstory a bit, doesn't she? And, you know, it sounds like she's educated herself with the encyclopedia, and she talks about being raped. And then, but towards the end, she kind of disappears off the scene and is just kind of rescued quite perfunctorily at the end, isn't she? So she just does just come a kind of a damsel in distress, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes back to the whole casting thing. I think if you'd had maybe an actor who was both very beautiful, but also had actual chops to pull it off. You might have got a little bit more out of Honey, but it wasn't what they were interested in, was it? They weren't interested in that kind of nuance, really. And to be fair, that was the same through most of the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s. You know, you've still got like Denise Richards popping up in a tank top as a nuclear scientist at the end of the 90s. You know, it's like, come on. It's only really when you start getting people like Eva Green come in that you really start to get Bond girls for the moment. With one or two exceptions over the run of Bond, but you start to get a Bond girl who really holds their own.
Do you think the phrase Bond girl needs to be retired? Because some people would say it has to be, in the sense that it probably kind of is associating the women in these films with being childlike in a sort of way. Although it's a common phrase and it's used like in the press and all of that. I don't know. What do you think? Any qualms?
You're probably right. You are probably right. I think what would we say instead? I mean, obviously Bond woman, I guess. But then does that imply an ownership? You know, does it all just imply an ownership that, you know, we shouldn't do anymore? Should it just be the female lead in a Bond movie? You know, it doesn't roll off the tongue in the same way, but maybe it's more appropriate now.
I have no problem with you want to use the phrase. I just tend to avoid it for that reason. That's all I'm saying. I'm not gonna cancel you, Tony. Don't worry.
Consequence me, not cancel. Yeah.
I can tell you that Ursula Andress really liked Ian Fleming because they met. Of course, that's the interesting thing. Fleming's around for the first couple of Bond films, isn't he, before he dies?
Yeah.
So then he mentions her by name in On Her Majesty's Secret Service when he writes that, which is an interesting little connection. Honey was supposed to be tanned, but Ursula Andress turned up with very pale skin. So you're actually seeing her with a lot of makeup plastered on her in the film. It's funny because on the DVD commentary, she jokes about how lots of people wanted to come in on that day and stand around watching her have the makeup applied to her. She's wearing the bikini and all that. And it's the kind of anecdote that obviously she's saying it is quite a lighthearted thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would come across that way today, you know.
No, you're looking and go, ooh, that's a bit skeevy. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's different. She is quite a different character in the book. In the book, I think she also has a crooked nose or something, which...
Yeah.
It means she's a bit less physically idealized, but you can also see that as a bit kind of reductive, like it's a sign that Bond needs to fix her. It's just kind of a reminder of that or something. I think the book plays up her expertise a bit more and the fact that she's resourceful. And I think they mention it in the film, but then she just kind of gets taken away by Dr. No's henchman, you know, and he rescues her very easily at the end. I do love that stuff where they go into... Actually, no, before we get there, there's a stuff about the dragon, which I don't think they get as much out of that as they could. Do you know what I mean? Like, it makes Quarrel and Honey seem a bit silly for having been taken in by it. The fact that it's so obviously a tank. Do you know what I mean? It seems like that could have been done quite differently, I think.
I think that's one of those examples of it worked a bit better in the book, really.
Yeah.
You know, in that you could... It's a daft idea either way. And in a way, it is almost Bondian, you know, if you think about the extravagance and the ridiculousness of some of the things, like, you know, you only live twice, where you've got like the space thing that eats like ships, or you know, eats shuttles or whatever. Yeah. You've got a lot of that in Bond, but yeah, it's almost like mythological kind of stuff that I suppose it's sort of treating them as like very sort of simple-minded local folk with their silly traditions, and then Bond comes in as this swaggering, you know, English city man from London who knows better and all this kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's a bit reductive for them, isn't it?
I think so. However, I love the stuff when they get to Dr. No's residence or whatever you call it, his complex, you know, when they get welcomed in, there's like Sister Rose and Sister Lily or whatever, and it's very kind of polite and all of that. We're here to make your stay as pleasant as possible. And they're being shown to these like luxurious rooms. I just love the kind of dissonance of that. And then you get a very moody scene with Dr. No appearing in the doorway, don't you? Like the long shadow on the floor. You just see his legs. So they keep us waiting a long, long time for Dr. No, which is interesting.
But again, like those are two things that again repeats throughout Bond. Yeah. Like, you know, the whole urbane welcome to here, you know, even up to Spectre, you've got that sort of come in, and it's very, very relaxed and very nice, even though they're going to try and kill you later. And then also the waiting for the villain. I mean, look at Silver in Skyfall, you know, and how they make you wait. Yeah. That is absolutely... So that all comes from Dr. No. You know, that all was there right at the beginning.
And also the fact that he doesn't... you know, his hand... What are they actually saying with the hands? Because he's got the black kind of glove type things, isn't he? But that idea of, like, the physical deformity, which, you know, on some level, the villain... Bond even says it to him. Like, Bond says, like, are you just trying to compensate for the fact that you don't have hands, you know? But that recurs, doesn't it? We get some kind of physical affliction, which is quite crude, but it happens with a lot of the Bond villains, like Scaramanga's third nipple or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So that's set up from the offset as well, which is interesting.
It is. It feels like they're kind of trying to establish the villain. I mean, Dr. No is particularly this, the other, the villain as being the other, you know. Dr. No is, sometimes they're quite frequently sort of ethnic, as it were, but they're quite hard to place. Like, I think Dr. No says he's like the son of a German missionary and a Chinese girl.
Half Chinese, yeah.
Yeah, who had, like, his hands were cut off by a triad gang and replaced with pincers and things like this. And it's like, well, and you don't quite get a beat on his sexuality. Like, there is this strange, either asexuality or strange sexuality to him. And it is that... You get that. I mean, you see that in character. I think you see similar kinds of things in characters like Drax in Moonraker. You know, they're not quite of this world in a way. They're slightly, and I think it's like trying to position them as extremely sort of strange and weird, almost like Fu Manchu like in their weirdness. I think that in a way is a bit of a, much as Joseph Wiseman is great in this role. I think if that was today, there would be an accusation of casting that is racially inappropriate. Do you know what I mean? I think you would actually have that accusation leveled now, and people would be like, "No, you can't do this." You know.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's interesting though. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's actually 87 minutes into the film when you first see Dr. No properly. You know, when you actually see Wiseman's face.
Wow, that is mad, isn't it? How long's the film? Is it like 110 minutes or something?
It's 1 hour 49. So, yeah.
Okay.
Just under. Yeah.
That's mad then, isn't it? That he's only in the last, literally the last act.
It's
basically
unusual. Yeah. It's an unusually structured film, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Joseph Wiseman was the second choice. Ian Fleming suggested Noel Coward for the role.
That would have been mad, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That would have been fascinating to think of, actually. But
Coward's reply was quite interesting because he sent a telegram. And it just said, no, no, no.
I worry it might have ended up like when he played the old con in the Italian job.
Yeah,
that's what worries me.
Yeah. I think another moment which doesn't land today in the same way, because it was topical at the time, but it's when they've met Dr. No and they're going through to the other room to have dinner and Bond stops and looks at that painting. Do you know what that's referring to?
No.
Okay, so... Joanna Harwood suggested this. This was the fact that there was a stolen Goya painting at this time of the Duke of Wellington. So the joke is that Dr. No has got the stolen painting, and that's why Bond recognises it. And it's funny, because if you look at some of the contemporary reviews for the film, they all highlight that moment, which when I first saw the film completely puzzled me. I didn't know what it referred to.
Well, you know, we do know, after all, that Bond is like an aficionado of
absolutely
culture.
Everything.
I mean, Do you remember when you thinking what I'm thinking when we watched Moonraker? And he was in Venice and he goes, 14th century. And we were like, how do you know that? Like, you're a secret agent. Yeah, I love him. It's great. He can do anything.
It's so fun when he'll know about a particular vintage of wine or something.
It's rubbish. Yeah.
The line I was talking about is, does toppling American missiles really compensate for having no hands? That's what I was thinking about. It's quite on the nose. Actually, surprisingly on the nose for this film. You know.
Yeah.
What do you make about Dr. No then? Because I'd forgotten that Spectre was teed up so early. Because in the books, it's Smirsch, isn't it? For the
Smirsch,
first few
yeah.
books. But here we talked about Spectre. What was it? The Special Executive of Counterterrorism, Revenge and Extortion. Is that
Revenge
right?
Revenge and Extortion. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Such a great
yeah.
acronym.
It's a mouthful.
The idea that he's kind of been spurned by both the East and West is kind of interesting. I think Fleming was onto something, wasn't he? He was kind of ahead of his time in the sense that he saw how much, an, you know, some kind of actor who's not affiliated with a state, how much trouble they could cause. That's quite a potent idea. And that kind of resonates up to the present day, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. And I think that was one of the major appeals for these films. I think the idea that, I mean, that's why what's one of the reasons that they changed it from Smersh as well, because they didn't want it to be overtly Russian. You know, they wanted, I mean, it did make me laugh when Cubby Broccoli's come out and said, "We never had politics in our minds at all. We never thought they were political films." he has actually said something to that effect before when he was alive. I was like, "Oh, come on, Cubby." Like, because they are all political, but you're right in that they position the villains for the most part in that kind of other space, that space, as you say, they're like a meddler. They're a meddler. They're trying to disrupt the order. They're either trying to usually it's pitting East and West against each other.
Yeah.
You know, essentially trying to create the conditions for a third world war. And sometimes you understand why. Sometimes it's a bit more, well, what are you going to gain from this? You know, what are you going to get out of it?
In Tomorrow Never Dies, when it sort of pivots on the fact that he wants television rights, for, you know, radio rights for the next 100 years or whatever it is.
Yeah. You're like, you haven't thought this through, have you, Elliot? You know, but yeah, I think, but again, you see that kind of position that No takes as, you know, repeated even in the non-Spectre kind of films, you know, that people like Drax or Stromberg, you know, particularly in the 70s, those kind of characters who are deliberately trying to blow everything up to create a new world, whether under the ocean or in space or whatever. But this is obviously rooted, I think, a lot more in that Cold War sort of hot missile sensibility of the time. And Spectre are that behind the scenes kind of manipulator. And it's one of the reasons why, for all, and we've talked at length about the film Spectre, but one of the reasons, and I think we mentioned this when we talked about it on Motion Pictures, one of the reasons I really like what they do in that is because what Blofeld's after is information. He's looking for something that he can use to upset the global order. He's not necessarily interested in conquest. And I like that. And I like the fact that they are slightly removed from this and they want to, you know, get something different from it.
Yeah, I think it's worth giving the plug, actually. So we did a couple of episodes of the Motion Pictures podcast, which is on an indefinite hiatus at the minute because we're just too busy, basically. But we did about almost 20 odd, I think. So there's a nice little back catalogue. And we did an episode on Spectre, the underrated James Bond film Spectre, which we both feel. Which many people disagree with us and think it's one of the worst. And we did one on Sean Connery after he passed away. So obviously we talked a bit about Bond there. So I just point people in that direction. Any thoughts on the sort of action stuff at the end here? Because you get Bond, it takes a while to play out because he goes into the shaft and that takes some time. Then he's in the reactor room trying to pass himself off as one of the workers. And he fights with Dr. No and he rescues Honey and so on. I think compared to what we get in subsequent films, do you find it a bit lackluster? I always kind of feel that way when I watch it, as much as I like the film very much overall. But what do you reckon?
Yeah, it's not that exciting, really. I think it's quite dated. I think it's a little bit pedestrian, really, considering. But then that's okay. That was one of the evolutions that it made as time went on, and that these things got bigger and bolder and, you know, more spectacular as time. You know, we're not quite at the point where you've got a massive volcano set, and you've got tons of people streaming down and all this. And it's good in this. I mean, I suppose it's one of those things. How do you end a film like this? I suppose at this point, you know, you've done all the setup. You've had him do the investigation. You meet the villain, and then you've got to have a showdown, I guess, really. Yeah. But the endings are always usually harder in a way to pull off than the build up. So it's okay, but it's not really a memorable conclusion, is it, really, in terms of the Bond lexicon, I suppose.
Well, I think I've heard it might have been a bit more dramatic if they'd been able to pull off what they wanted to in one sense, which is that they were going to have a scene with Honey being attacked by crabs.
Wow, okay. Crab Key, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, what happened was they shipped in all these crabs, but they'd been kept at too cold a temperature. So when they get them out to film the scene, they're all kind of like half dead, and they're moving really slowly. And it just didn't look menacing, apparently, and the scene was a disaster.
Amazing.
So they took the crabs out, and they create this kind of flooding effect. But I think it makes it a bit less dramatic, because he just comes along and shackles her and pulls her out, doesn't he? So that's a shame. I think in the book, there's a set piece with Bond and a giant squid. I would have loved to have seen them attempt that.
Yeah. If only you could go back and add the CGI. Because that would be fascinating, yeah.
if they remake part of me wants them to remake, you know, I think that with Spectre they've started to bring back like Blofeld and so on. And
I think they have, Carl. I think if you look at the trailer for No Time to Die, I'm convinced that that's Dr. No's base at the end. I think they've done it.
First.
So, yeah, we'll see in a couple of months.
That's interesting. Hopefully we'll get the giant squid then. Yeah, and then quite a standard ending with Bond and Honey on the boat, isn't it? And I think this becomes quite a familiar... But I don't think any sense that, you know, there's going to be like wedding bells or anything like that. I think it's just a nice little clinch at the end, isn't it? You know,
which in a way, I suppose, is interesting because we're before the point where he has a different girl every film. You know, would you have... I mean, did anyone really expect a sequel necessarily in the same way? Probably not. Necessarily, maybe they would have thought he would have gone off into the sunset with Honey, watching it then, you know, maybe unless you've read the books and you know that he's got a different female, you know, it's hard to say. I think now we take it for granted that that's the standard Bond ending of that first, you know, era, but maybe people would have seen it differently at the time.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I can actually maybe shed some light on that, but first of all, let me just tell you that so the film had premiered in London in October 62. It was a hit. It was a hit in the USA. I think it came out in the spring of 1963 in America. I think I heard on the DVD that it earned 20 times its $1 million budget on original release. So pretty good going. And,
yeah.
And they obviously wanted to make sequels anyway, but that just made it a complete no-brainer.
Yeah.
I printed off a couple of reviews from the time because I thought that would be interesting to see how people took a Bond film without any knowledge of there being more Bond films and it being part of a series. So I've got a subscription to Sight and Sound, and it gives you, as part of that, you get into their archive, and you can pull up Sight and Sound magazine. And
oh, that's good.
Also, the monthly film bulletin as well. So let's see here. In the monthly film bulletin, the reviewer said, the film is obviously destined to be the first of a James Bond series. So that interested me, that they were talking about it immediately as being the first of potentially many, or first of
right,
more.
Right, okay.
But they said... And yet, strangely enough, excitement and humour and the glamour of corruption are all rather lacking. Dr. No misses the genuine sadistic, sybaritic... I don't even know what that means. Sybaritic relish attributed to Fleming's novels and the narrative invention of even second-rate Hitchcock. I can see what they're sort of saying, because it is quite A to B to C, you know.
Yeah.
But that's part of what I like about it, is it's like an airport thriller kind of brought to the cinema screen. You know what I mean? An airport novel kind of...
Done
quite well. Sean Connery is such a disappointingly wooden and boorish Bond that the script's touches of grim humour go for less than they need. However, they do say more positively, the producers could well be onto a good thing with these stories. They might feel more encouraged to throw caution to the winds and just let things rip. And to be fair, that's kind of what they actually do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it does go in that direction of bigger, more excessive. So I understand that.
And relatively quickly as well. You know, I mean, even though Russia with Love doesn't do that as such, it's still a bigger and more thrilling movie than Dr. No.
And definitely by the time you get into, like, Thunderball, you know.
Oh, God, yeah.
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 In Sight and Sound, so this is Penelope Houston reviewing the film. She said, It has taken James Bond a surprisingly long time, all things considered, to reach the screen. But now that he has arrived, it seems he is here to stay. So again, just an immediate sense of this is the start of something. She says, Dr. No makes almost no appeal that is not to everyone's worst instincts. Innocent blood and thunder have been left some way behind as Mr. Fleming drives straight for the subconscious. Terence Young has not managed to find a visual equivalent for the high vulgarity of the writer's style. That's an interesting line to me. And as much as I like the film, I think there's maybe a little bit to that. You know, the visual panache increases as time goes on.
Yeah. I think so. It's interesting to hear people talking about that it's taken more time than you think to adapt it, actually, as well, because that suggests that people were waiting for this then.
Yeah.
And I suppose maybe the Bond books were popular, you know, at the time, but yeah, it's almost, you almost forget that maybe there was an anticipation in that era of this becoming a franchise. I mean, we take it for granted now when you get a hit book series and you're like, oh, they're going to make the movie or they're going to make the TV show. But yeah, maybe that was the case a bit more then than we remember, actually.
Well, what I read is that in 1958, Cubby Broccoli tried to persuade his partner at the time, Irving Allen, to turn the Bond books into films. So it could have happened earlier. But what happened was that Allen and Fleming had a meeting that was disastrous. So it kind of goes on the back burner for a bit.
Yeah.
Then 2 years later, Harry Saltzman splits from Woodfall Films, Woodfall being the company that makes a lot of the sort of British New Wave kitchen sink type stuff. Because it's really interesting to see his name pop up in a lot of the credits of those films.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Then he options the Bond novels, I think. Broccoli splits from Irving Allen. They end up meeting, Broccoli and Saltzman. Cubby Broccoli wanted to buy his option out, but Saltzman wanted it to be a partnership. And then they get together with United Artists and the deal is done, blah, blah, blah. They form Eon Productions and I think it's Dan Jack, isn't it, that holds the film rights to the company. And then what? Broccoli and Saltzman. So how Saltzman exits the stage eventually, doesn't he? But it's a while yet, isn't it? It's after the Connery era, isn't it?
I think it's after Man with the Golden Gun. I think Spy Who Loved Me is the Broccoli onwards era. Yeah.
Yeah. And then after Cubby Broccoli's on the scene for quite a long time. Is GoldenEye the first one that comes after he's passed away?
I think he dies. I think he sees GoldenEye made.
Right.
And he watches it. But I don't think he was that involved because I think at that point he was ill and he was old and stuff. And there from then on. So I think it was more Barbara Broccoli really at that point, Michael G. Wilson. And then it's been the case really.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to know what the next generation is in time. Takes up the baton.
Will it be them? That's the big question now after what we talked about at the start. I hope so. But I like the fact it's this family legacy in a way. So I hope that continues.
Yeah, me too. Just finally going back to the Sight and Sound review, she says, meanwhile, Dr. No is an unusually shrewd production job down to the really solid look of the Doctor's underwater headquarters and atomic plant and of the flamethrower tank he sends scurrying about his island. One really excellent joke, revealing the whereabouts of the National Gallery's missing Goya, almost tempts one to let this reprehensible but admittedly watchable film off with a caution.
Reprehensible, that's a fun term for this.
Yeah.
And that they thought it was the really sort of, naughty, edgy. And that's the thing, it's tame now, but it's back then, this was, this is a bit
hot stuff.
Strong. Yeah.
All right, Tony, I think we can leave it there. I think we've chewed this one over pretty well. Unless there's anything else you wanted to bring up about Dr. No, but I think we've gone through the main beats, haven't we? So
I think so, yeah. It's definitely one of those films in terms of the Bond saga that I think I suspect that it's not one that people would necessarily go back to as much as they do some of the others, even some of the other 60s ones. But if you haven't seen this in a while, go back and have another look, because this is a really well-rounded, well-made thriller of that era, and it just oozes class and style. It's been really fun to talk about it, because I'm really glad that I've kind of got Dr. No, after all these years. I feel enriched for that as a Bond fan.
Do you think it's one that would appeal to somebody who doesn't really like James Bond, like in the way that my partner doesn't like James Bond, but she likes Skyfall quite a lot,
Right.
Would this appeal to somebody of that kind of opinion? Because it's early, because it doesn't have all the trappings.
It might do, but it might be too old now, in a way. It might be a bit too dated, in some sense. It's hard to say, really. I think maybe, something like On Her Majesty's Secret Service, in a way, but then that's quite long and all over. I'll just show her Octopussy. You're going to get anyone into Bond, you show them Octopussy, obviously. That's how it works.
I really like Octopussy, I got to say.
I love Octopussy, but I am absolutely joking.
All right, Tony, we'll leave it there. So what are you up to online, my good friend? What's going on these days? What are you up to?
Oh, lots of stuff. I'm still writing books. You can keep track of that on AJ Black Writer on Twitter, which is where I mainly hang out. I am writing a book on Sean Connery, actually, and how. So I have a whole chapter on Dr. No, as well as all the 60s Bond movies, and Diamonds Are Forever, and Never Say Never Again. So that's a lot of fun, going through all these movies and unpicking all the cultural stuff around it. So that's going to be out next year, and that's great. So I'm doing that, so you keep track of me on there. And then the general We Made This Network, which you're on, obviously, and this show's on. And you can find the kind of things I'm popping up on over there as well at WMT_network. So, yeah.
Are we going to get a full chapter on Zardoz?
Do you know what? Actually, possibly yes.
Oh, good. That's really good.
I can't wait to rewatch that.
This must be like further down the line, is it? What are we talking, next year, the year after, potentially? Or?
It will be at the earliest, I think, well into 2022. Yeah, it's due at the end of the year, so we'll see if I can get it done by then.
We'll find a way to mark that on the podcast, I think, for sure. That sounds really good.
Oh, thanks.
All right, so I'm on Twitter at CKJSweeney. You can find Movie Palace on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod. You can also find us on Facebook and on Instagram. But that's all for this episode, everybody. So thanks for listening. I hope you can join us next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Cerebral Jukebox.
She was like, okay, do you want to play Spin the Bottle with me? Now, as a 13-year-old, I was probably one of the most nervous wrecks on the face of the planet. I was like, well, I can't just like play. I'm not playing with like everyone says. I was like, oh no, like, can we play Spin the Bottle? I'm like, yeah, but that would just be, oh, Jesus, I'm just a kisser. So that's what happened.
Life's milestones.
With me at this time is Alexa. Alexa, hello.
Hi there.
So, my first ever electronic guest here on Life's Milestones. Alexa, how old are you?
I'm as old as my tongue and a little older than my teeth. Or I would be if I had any. Sorry, I'm being silly. What do you expect from a 5-year-old? Thanks for being interested in me. Here's another fun thing. Try asking me to sing you a silly song.
Pretty Fly, a 90s nostalgia podcast.
In the modern day, the harmonica it's a sophisticated instrument of class and distinction.
Yeah, it's right up there with the harpist chord and, you know, the cathedral organ.
Did you just say the harpist chord?
Yes.
I mean the harpsichord?
I do mean the harpsichord. Thank you for that.
Like, hang on a minute. Did this guy just say harpist chord?
I did.
Oh, who's goodness. Sophisticated now?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Hello everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis, that's patreon.com/WeMadeThis, and get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.